Hello, everyone out there, or wherever you may be. Hopefully this webcast may find you in good spirits and in great health. Hopefully you're as ready as I am for the next esteemed guest on the Boing Podcast. And hopefully you're ready for another full hour and a half, maybe even a little bit longer, of this wonderful, unfiltered, not from concentrate, preservative-free cartooning goodness. Coming up after these great messages from our sponsors.
Having dinner with Fancy, eh?
Yeah, Kellogg's cornflakes. Oh, I can hardly wait.
Kellogg's cornflakes? He shouldn't waste them on women when TC's around.
Hello, TC.
Fancy, you Romeo, you got a dinner date.
Yeah.
Let me give you a few pointers.
But
first, just sweep her off her feet.
Ain't we just having cornflakes?
How can you think of food at a time like this? Haven't you dreamed of this baby as I have?
Yeah.
You're on your own, boy.
Hello, Fancy.
Haven't you dreamed of this baby as I have?
Fresh.
Oh, troubles, Fancy? I'll fix you some Kellogg's cornflakes. Best like, best flavor. Here's the best dinner date in the world.
Where?
Here, a delicious bowl of Kellogg's cornflakes shared with a nose and trusted friend.
Ooh, not bad, Barney boy.
Ta-ta, chump, champ.
Let's go, Tyrone. I've got an idea.
Yes, sir. A glass of Welch coming up. Welch Aid's the power pack refresher because it's made with genuine Welch's grape juice, and grapes are rich in levulose, the natural energy food you athletes need.
Yeah, and I love that good grape taste. Down in front, Barney. Four.
Hey, what the... Oh.
Barney, a hole in one! Have some Welch Aid, Barney. Welch Aid's the power pack refresher.
Oh boy, hole in one, here I come. Four.
And four extra power get Welch Aid. With my picture on the can.
Take one at bar 54.
As a young boy in the late 60s and early 70s, transfixed in front of my family's color TV set, it never once occurred to me that behind all of that cartoony goodness in the likes of the Flintstones, Peter Potamus, the Jetsons, and Wacky Races, as well as Fang Face, just to name a few, were many talented artists, designers, and animators laboring away in their studios somewhere in sunny California. All I knew that as a kid growing up in the happy hills of upstate New York, Saturday mornings were the highlight of my week. Added to that, my bowl of Quisp cereal, and life was as good as it could get. Jerry Eisenberg is one of these creative geniuses responsible for the joy of my youth in the 60s and early 70s, and he's a true original, and I was so fortunate to be able to catch up with him in his home in LA so he could share his experiences, expertise, and opinions related to the world of animation. Jerry's amazing career has taken him along many different and interesting paths, and he will generously take you back down those trails right along with him, if you just ask. And that, I certainly did. So sit back and relax for the next hour and a half as I talk to the legendary Jerry Eisenberg. We begin the interview with Jerry just warming up. and taking us back to his youth, where his whole animated life is set in motion.
Well, I was born in Queens, New York, and we lived out there at my grandparents' house in Woodhaven, and my mother brought me out to Los Angeles to rejoin my father, who was working with Joe Barbera at MGM. They had worked together in New York. That's where they met, and they both lived in Brooklyn, and they became friends. They used to go to drive to work together, and Joe came out to the West Coast first, and then they kept in touch, and he got my father to come out and work with him at MGM on the, you know, Tom and Jerry cartoons.
Right, right. Wow, that's really cool. So were there times like just that Joe would just show up at your house, or was it, I mean, did you see him regularly?
My father was working in the studio, but once in a while, I remember him coming to the house, mainly if, like a few times my father and Joe would go off on a weekend, like up to either Lake Arrowhead or Big Bear or somewhere, you know, like a little holiday.
Yeah.
Just with the two guys. And I'd see him that way. My mother said something really cute some years later. She said when she first met him, she said, oh, he was gorgeous. You know, he was wearing a black sweater with a white shirt. And she said, he looked like Cary Grant.
Yeah, that's funny. Well,
she was just...
That's funny.
It really amazing.
Now, obviously the talent was in the gene pool there. But when did you start to, like, were you always interested in it, or when did you just say, hey, you know, I can do this, you know, I've got the ability, or did your dad point?
It started in probably maybe preschool or kindergarten. I remember once doing a little. It was almost like a painting of a Chinese boat, a junk, and I don't know whatever happened to it, but by the time I was in the first and second grade, the only thing I can remember, I was drawing pyramids all the time. I guess I was intrigued with pyramids, but I cannot remember why, you know.
Yeah.
The only thing I can think of is I remember on the soda pop bottles, Royal Crown Cola had three pyramids on the label, but I don't know if it's that. Maybe, you know, we didn't have television. Maybe it was in a movie I saw some pyramids. I don't know.
It's funny.
But I wish I could remember more. I think I was always scribbling and doodling. And one day, I remember when I was in the second grade, it was, in those days, there was 2B and 2A. You'd start in the B class. One day the principal or vice principal came to the class and called me out in the hallway. And then she walked me down the hall, up the stairs, and down the next hall to the 2A room. And I've always remembered her words. She said to me, she said, you are now in the 2A class. Your teacher in 2B doesn't want you anymore.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
So I got skipped, and then I got skipped once again at another grammar school, but that was under my merits, you know.
Yeah. Wow.
I must have been a little disruptive, or who knows, she might have been a grouchy person. I can't remember the teacher at all. But maybe it annoyed her that I was always drawing, and I was talking sometimes too much. I don't know.
That's funny. That's funny.
I wish I could remember. It's some people can remember that. You know, usually they say you can remember back to the age of four. Possibly three, but I can't seem to go quite that far back.
That's funny. Now, obviously, at some point, either was it your dad or somebody that looked at your scribbles or your drawings and said, "Hey, you know, you got something here," or did you, you know?
Well, I can't say I remember that, but he was helpful to me when I was in high school, mm-hmm. and I used to watch him draw, like. At the home, when they had their garage built, because the homes didn't come with garages, only a foundation for it. And when he had it built, he had it built an extra 9 feet longer because he built a studio room behind the garage. How can... You know, it was part of the garage, but I meant there was a wall separating the garage and the studio. Uh-huh. And he used to work out there a lot. So I used to watch him sometimes, and he would show me things. I don't know.
That's neat. That's really cool. So then, okay, well then, how did you, at that point, how did you get your start then into, I mean, did you go to college, or how did that progress?
Well, what I did was, in high school, I entered the Los Angeles Examiner newspaper had a high school sports page, like on Wednesday and Saturday, they would publish it, or print it, and it was all about high school sports and stuff like that. So there was a contest to be a sports cartoonist for the paper, you know, for the high school section. So I answered, and luckily I won it. I think I was in the 10th grade, and I was in that program for 2.5 years till I graduated. And I guess I won the contest twice. There was another contest maybe when I was in the 11th grade or something. And so they awarded me a scholarship to the Chouinard Art Institute, which was an art college in Los Angeles. Great place. I really liked it a lot. It now has morphed into a school called Cal Arts, if you've heard of that.
Oh, yeah. Course.
But it started as Chouinard, and then when they Disney was always involved with Chouinard. He supported the place, and he would, you know, hire people out of the art school for his studio. And then, of course, he put a lot of money into the building the new place out in Valencia. You know, he probably paid for most of the land.
Yeah.
And now it's called CalArts. I don't know why they dumped the Chouinard name.
Hmm.
You know, they could even use the Disney name, for goodness sake. Maybe he didn't want that. I really don't know. I never checked on that.
That's funny. Yeah, that's interesting that would...
Yeah. I imagine there might be information somewhere on that, you know.
Yeah.
Probably in the studio archives.
So did you go all the way through the training there at that school, or did you...
I was there for about 2 years. What happened was I was under scholarship, and near the end of the second year, well, after the first year, they put me on a working scholarship, which meant after school I would have to stay over with some of the other scholarship students and help clean up some of the rooms, you know, brooming and whatever, and then come in on Saturday mornings to do that. So that lasted for several more months. Then they sent a questionnaire around, had all the scholarship students take it was like a financial questionnaire to take to your parents. And at that time, my parents had separated for the final time. You know, they'd gone through a couple of others. Mm-hmm. And I just didn't want to... You know, my father, I guess, made enough money. It showed on the financial thing that he could afford to pay my tuition. But since they were separated and planning to get a divorce, I knew that he'd still have to find a place to live and still help support my mother and me. Mm-hmm. So I didn't have the heart to ask him to pay tuition. So that's when I decided I'm going to go to work.
Wow.
And he arranged an appointment for me with Joe Barbera. So I took my portfolio to MGM, and he hired me, you know, as an apprentice in-betweener in the animation department. You know, usually you start as an in-betweener, then you become an assistant animator, and then eventually an animator. But what I found out, I visited my old boss at the Examiner, two or three years later, and I told him what happened. He said, "Jerry, why didn't you call me?" He said that 3-year scholarship was set up so where it was like unchangeable. They had no right to put you on a working scholarship or even send home that questionnaire. Oh, he was mad, but it was too late, you know. And what was unfortunate, he said, I would have called Walt Disney and had him straighten out the school about that. But it was, you know, I never thought to call his name was Ira Walsh. Mm-hmm. when this was happening. My parents did. You know, the thing is, we all just trusted what the school was saying, but we did not verify.
Right.
So I was really, I would have loved to have gone to school another year, year and a half, but it was okay. I don't regret, because I started my career at MGM, and it's been great.
Yeah, no doubt, yeah.
One thing, I've had great experiences, worked with great people, all different ages and talents, and once in a while I'd stop and think how fortunate I am to make a good living drawing silly pictures, because it's rough out there. You know, it's hard out there for most people. There's a lot of unemployment, especially now.
Yeah.
And not everybody likes what they do.
No kidding. No.
Hey, I'm going on too long now. Your turn.
No, that's great. That's great. Now, you, so walking in the doors at MGM, that had to be, was there just like this big rush of emotion? Like, you have to almost wonder, like, oh, my God, how did I land here? I mean, you knew how you got there, but it's like, that had to be really exciting.
It was very exciting. And what was I going to say? My father had worked there. And I don't know. And just being right across the street from the main lot, you know, we could go over on the main lot and have lunch sometimes at the commissary. And you could watch a lot of the stars there. And one of the men that went over with us one time, he knew Rock Hudson, and so I got to meet Rock Hudson once. Things like that were kind of exciting.
That's neat. That's neat.
Yeah.
So now what happens from MGM? What's next? Where do you go?
Well, what happened, after 7 months of being there, they decided to close the division.
Yeah.
Of course, Joe and Bill had tried to, they made a presentation to the studio executives, like, how about getting into television cartoons? The studio wasn't interested. So lucky for them, they started their own studio. They got together with, who was that director? All of a sudden I'm blanking out on his name, but because they did a cartoon sequence for him for one of the MGM movies. You know, I don't know if it was that one with Gene Kelly. Well, Gene was in two. He was in one called Invitation to the Dance, and the other one was maybe Anchors Away or something like that.
Okay.
Anyway, so they started up with the help of... George Sidney was the director's name, and he invested some money to help them get started. And what was it? They were working... They had offices in the beginning at the Chaplin Studios up on La Brea below Sunset Boulevard. Charlie Chaplin had built that studio, I think, back in the 20s.
Jeez. God, that's neat.
So I was out of work. I was out of work for 3 or 4 months. And then I got hired at, I checked with studios once in a while. I went to Disney, and they liked my work and offered me a position. But I didn't have a car at that time. My car had been, somebody smashed into it. So I was looking for one. And I was using my mother's car to get out to Disney. So I said, gee, I don't have a car right now to be able to come out here. They said, well, when will you have one? I said, hopefully within the next 3 or 4 weeks. So they said, okay, give us a call then. So when I got a car, I called them, and they just had a layoff.
Oh, my God.
So I missed working there, but then I kept in touch with Warner Brothers, and I ended up working there for about 4 years. That was what a great experience at Warner Brothers.
I bet. So what were some of the, what were you doing there then? What was your role?
Well, I was still an in-betweener.
Okay.
Because I'd only worked as an in-betweener for 7 months, so I really didn't have enough experience to become an assistant. But I worked in the in-between room for all three units. There was Frizz Freeling's unit, Chuck Jones, and Bob McKimson. And I really liked Chuck's stuff the most. And his writer, Mike Maltese, and he had a great crew. But I really liked what they were doing, especially, when Mike Maltese was there, it was great. When he left to go to Hanna-Barbera, then, Chuck's cartoons weren't quite as good, I felt. They sort of were declining a bit because the writing wasn't as good.
Right.
Mike was really a fun, really nice person. And, so when I, maybe I'm getting ahead of myself.
No, that's fine.
Anyway, my friend Willie Ito was the assistant animator for Ken Harris, who was in Chuck's unit. And I always did a lot of in-betweens for Ken and Willie. So when Willie left, he wanted to go work with Bob Clampett at his Snowball studio. And so that left an opening, and fortunately, Ken asked for me to be his assistant. So I got to become an assistant animator, and then I was there working for at least a couple of years in that position. And then I left in 61 to work at Hanna-Barbera.
Now,
but previously, back in maybe 58 or 59, Joe Barbera kept in touch, and he offered me a position there in layout. I was very interested in layout design. My father had been a layout man, too. And but my father advised me at that time. He said, why don't you stay at Warner's a little longer and gain some more animation experience, which was good advice. So I followed that. But then I finally got restless. They were giving me a little animation to do, but not that much. And but then I just finally decided I'm going to work at Hanna-Barbera. I actually worked 1 week there while I was on when the studio was closed for 2 weeks of vacation. I worked 1 week at Hanna-Barbera, and I loved it. You know, I did my first layouts there, and when I was doing the layouts, I missed animation. You know, I was really interested in animation too. So when I would pose a character for the scene, I would do several drawings maybe. I'd be almost like animating him.
I gotcha.
But that sort of made up for my not doing animation at Warner's. So I was kind of doing that. And I've been lucky. I've always been very fast. So I could take the time to do several extra drawings, you know. But it was really fun because we'd have a record of the voice track. You could hear the actors. And that would help you to, as far as what kind of a pose to make or
right.
an expression on the face, on the body. And that was great.
Well, just for those that might not know that you know, when they're listening, now, an in-betweener, the difference between an assistant animator and an in-betweener is what?
It starts with the animator. He will, let's say it's a scene that takes a total of, let's just say, 45 drawings.
Okay.
Well, the animator will do maybe 10 key drawings spaced throughout the scene. He'll do a rough of number one and whatever. Maybe he'll do number 7 or 10 and so on. He might do maybe 10 rough drawings. Then the assistant animator will clean those drawings up and then add a few more. And then let's say... like I say, 45 drawings. Let's say by the time the in-betweener is handed the scene, maybe, say, 20 or so drawings are already done. But in other words, I'd have to do the draw in between the assistant's drawings, you know?
Right.
Let's say he'd deliver a package to me where every other drawing was done, but I had to do the in-between drawings.
I get you. So if you've got a scene where, say, I don't know, a character's wielding a sledgehammer and he starts the start motion to the final motion, which is like the impact motion, the most,
yeah.
you know, you the person that's doing everything in between would be the in-betweener. The action in between.
Yeah, I mean, I don't know. It depends how fast the director times it out. You know, he could. The guy maybe anticipates, like, moving the sledgehammer back behind him, you know, let's say almost like a golfer
right.
or down low. And then there's a hesitation, then he brings it forward to hit whatever the object is. So I can only guess. I've been away from that for so many years. You know, let's say maybe it takes 15 drawings to do that.
Right.
So the in-betweener would do maybe 7 or 8, maybe 10 of those drawings.
I see. Okay. Makes sense.
Like roughly half of the drawings of the scene. A scene of 100 drawings, the in-betweener would probably do 50.
I get you. Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. I can't...
Did I leave anything out?
So then you went to, took advantage of a vacation, of a layoff period there at,
Well, it was actually the vacation time at Warner. What they did every year, the studio would say, look, they'd give everybody a choice. You'd have to vote. Everybody would vote, like, which two-week period would you like to be off? They'd give you, say, 2 weeks in July or 2 weeks in August. And you'd vote on which one you preferred. So I forget what month that was, but I was off for 2 weeks, and I don't know. I just decided I wanted to work a week at Hanna-Barbera just to kind of get familiar.
Oh, yeah. It's a brilliant move. I mean, it was a great move. So that worked out great for you.
Yeah, and I'm trying to remember. I think that must have been in 61 because I think I came back to work after vacation. I think maybe I gave my notice very, very soon after that. I just wanted to go work because Joe Barbera said, you can come and work here full time.
That's phenomenal.
So glad. And I was very lucky. I mean, I didn't know what was going to happen. The next year in 62, Warner Brothers decided to close their cartoon division.
Oh, my gosh. That was.
You know, my timing was very lucky, I guess.
Yeah, almost prophetic there. You know, that's wild. Yeah. So
I know. I remember Chuck met with me after I gave my notice. He wanted to keep me, and he said, well, we can give you some more animation. But I don't know. I'd already made up my mind. And it's a good thing I went to Hanna-Barbera anyway, because they closed Warner Brothers.
Now, at that point in 61, when you find yourself at Hanna-Barbera, was Hanna-Barbera at that point already taking off? Was it really, or was it just in its infancy? Had they, you know, were they?
Well, yeah, it was taking off because they started, I remember it was something like September of 57.
Mm-hmm.
And actually, from about 58 or 59, Bill Hanna called me around that time and asked me if my animator and I would be interested in animating commercials for them. So I asked Ken Harris if he would like to. He said, sure. So I would pick up and deliver the stuff. You know, we'd work on this stuff at home or at night at the studio, and I would deliver it and pick up the next assignment. So that went on for a couple of years. And then of course I left. You know, then I decided I wanted to work full time at Hanna-Barbera.
So now your new role at Hanna-Barbera is layout. Okay.
Well, it was again. I was like a beginning layout man. I don't know if they use the word apprentice. It's possible. But then, like after 3 or 4 months, Joe called me in his office and said, "Well, we're giving you a raise." They had a thing with the union, like every so many months, you would get moved up, you know.
Okay.
And it took about 3 steps, and then you were called a journeyman layout man.
I gotcha.
That took about a year, maybe.
All right, so.
But that was pretty neat.
Now, this is a question that I've always wanted to ask, and this is just how, like, when. Like, we'll just use Hanna-Barbera as the example. It's the best example here. Now, when you've got an idea for a new show, or how does the idea come about? Who starts that? Where, and then when do you get involved? And then how do you decide, like, what the episodes will be about and everything? How does that whole process start?
Yeah, well, I'm familiar with some of it, but not that much. And of course, I'm guilty, like most of the fellas. Then, you know, I didn't ask many questions. You know, I'm kind of sorry I didn't. You know, because, you know, of the interviews later on, like, it's not that I can't remember. There's a lot of things I didn't bother to just ask about or find out.
Oh, no problem. Sure.
But the ideas it all started during the development period, which would be about 6 months out of the year. Generally, it would last from October to March. And we would develop new ideas, and one of my specialties, besides layout and, you know, background design, was creating and designing characters. So usually it would start with Joe Barbera and maybe some of his writers who would, you know, come up with ideas. I guess he'd have a meeting with them. I was never in those meetings. Years later, they included some of us layout men with the writers, mm-hmm. but at that time I wasn't involved in that stage. And in those days the writers could all draw. It was like at Disney, all the writers there could draw. They would make their own storyboard scripts, so to speak.
Right, right.
They would do a script in a storyboard form, if you're familiar with storyboards.
Yes, yes, yes. Yeah, I think and that's what Tony had said, because Tony would draw as well for his...
Oh, his storyboard scripts were so fun. You know, he had a great sense of humor on the Flintstones and the Jetsons and yeah. other things. Now, where other storyboards, we'd have to sort of go over them maybe and fix them up. But with Tony's, they didn't really need hardly any change. Maybe Joe Barbaro would make some changes. But anyway, so Joe would say, I'm trying to remember, he'd come around and say, well, we got an idea for, let's see, I remember with the Wacky Races, he came down and said, we want to do a bunch of cars, you know, funny cars, funny people, different characters. And I think that he already had some names of the characters, and maybe some of the cars had names too.
Mm-hmm.
So, and, you know, it was kind of loose. Nothing was really pinned down, so we'd start designing stuff like that. I love designing cartoony cars and planes and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And so I think we had about 10 characters, maybe. He picked about 7 that I designed. I don't know if you want me to mention
absolutely, yeah. I used to love that show. So,
well, you mentioned in your letter the Slag Brothers. I designed that Boulder car, Boulder Mobile, with one caveman. But then I remember, Joe liked it. He said, that's fine. But then the next day or so, he'd come down and say, we decided, let's have 2 cavemen in the car. So I added a second caveman.
What about Professor Pat Pending?
Oh, that was designed, the character in the car, by Corny Cole, if you've heard of Corny.
The name is familiar. Yeah,
yeah, I met him at Warner Brothers. He was one of the assistant animators there. And then, you know, some years later, he joined us a couple of times at Hanna-Barbera, you know, but he didn't stay there for a long period. But he contributed that design. Evo Takamoto designed, there was a character called the Red Baron who had an automobile that looked like a World War I airplane.
Yes, yes, yeah.
He also designed Penelope Pitstop, I think was her last name. I tried to design her. I came close, but Evo was so good at drawing the girls, you know. But, you know, he worked 16 years at Disney before he came to Hanna-Barbera. But he was a hell of an artist.
Yeah, no doubt.
Boy, he could draw. You know, it was great to work with him for many years.
Who did, I cannot believe I've drawn a blank. The dog, the Muggsley?
Muttley?
Muttley.
That was done for the Yogi Bear feature. I remember Ewo and I worked on that, and I think Ewo may have done the Muttley design.
Yeah.
You know, I get a little fuzzy on some things, but I know the only thing we worked on that feature was we designed and laid out a song sequence, something with the St. Louis Bears, I think it was.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. I remember that. I remember here. That was such a great show. Now, who decided who won in each episode? I mean,
that I don't remember anything. I wasn't privy to that.
God,
I don't know. I guess the writer, they would talk with Joe, and that so maybe what each race, each episode had to have a different winner. Maybe I don't know if anybody duplicated the win. I don't know.
Yeah, I remember. I'm trying to remember some of it. There was Peter Perfect, I think. There was
that's one of my designs.
There you go. And then
there was one with I think the Arkansas Chug-a-Bug.
Yes, yeah, they were great.
Which I did.
Oh, that's great.
There was a logging type character with a beaver.
The beaver and a little bit. Yep, you did that one?
That was one. I remember doing the one with the two guys, the Army surplus tank?
Yes.
And then I did that. What is the car with the little mobsters? Was that the Anthill Mob, maybe?
Yes, the Anthill Mob. That's, yeah.
That was one. And can't remember. I can't remember. I did about seven is all I can remember.
I think there was one that reminded me of, like, Adam's Family. You know, it had, like, the...
Oh, yeah, that was one that I did. Exactly, yeah. Like, it had the little bit of what do you call that style of house that Charles Adams always had the characters in?
Yeah, that I can't remember. I know.
Can't think of it.
Yeah. It's like that Victorian...
Yeah, it was definitely Victorian, and there's another name I can't remember, but...
Yeah, it had to...
Yeah, I love Charles Adams' cartoons, but... And the funny thing is, after we did the Wacky Races show, the next development season, Joe said, let's do Wacky Submarines. I love the idea, so I had fun designing a whole bunch of wacky submarines, but he couldn't sell that one.
Gosh.
That was a shame. I think it could still be viable, but
yeah, I wonder where all that art. Where did all that artwork go?
They were saving stuff at the studio. I saved a lot of extra drawings that I had and roughs. And before I left in '75, the first time, I photographed a lot of stuff over a couple of nights. You know, that I worked on. Because I had a big cabinet in my room where we kept a lot of the artwork. The stuff that was mounted on large boards were kept in a special room upstairs, and they built a shelf system where you could store these things.
That's
and one day, what was it? We sent this one girl who was assisting us to go up and check out such and such boards from whatever the show was. She came back down and said, none of the artwork is up there. I said, what? So we went on a search, and in the warehouse building, all that stuff was piled up on the floor. And I'm thinking, what the? Somebody who, the head maintenance guy had one of his, maybe they needed the room for something, but you'd think they would have with Joe Barbera to begin with, or with you or me, and say, hey, we got to empty the room, or we would have taken the stuff and put it somewhere else.
Jeez.
I don't remember. Joe must have been furious about that. I'm sure we let him know. What a dumb thing to have. You know, that's the trouble with when you get people or executives that have no interest in art, or there's no respect sometimes for artwork.
Yeah, no doubt. Oh, yeah. It still goes on. So.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, years ago, I remember in '71 when Warner Brothers reopened their cartoon division and they hired this woman, Jackie Smith, who was assisting Fred Silverman at one of the networks and to be in charge. And then they hired away a couple of people from Hanna-Barbera. I think Alex Lovey was one. And but they never made a go of it. But at some point, we heard that the studio needed this small building. You know, it wasn't that big for some other files. And all the Warner Brothers artwork was there. You know, cells, drawings, painted backgrounds for probably going back to the 40s.
Oh.
And this stupid woman, you know, she, instead of calling the cartoon union or my friend Don Jerwich, his wife was personal friends with her, she could have called Don, could have called the union, said, we have to get rid of this stuff. Would you be interested in saving any of it? And I had saved some cells and things when I worked there, but I'm sorry now I didn't save more because so much of it was destroyed forever.
Oh, man.
They put it in dumpsters. And, I hated her for that, but I didn't wish her dead, but it's interesting. A couple of years later, she died of a cancer, and I said, the cartoon god must have taken revenge. What a, that's the trouble with people like that. No sensitivity, no respect. Just, dump the artwork. Not even thinking maybe somebody would like to save it, you know?
That's, that's awful. That's sad. I never knew that. That happened.
Yeah,
that's
wish it wouldn't have happened.
Yeah.
You know, I would have gone over there with Don. I would have grabbed some stuff to save, but and the union could have saved stuff and put it in the archives. And there are cartoon museums. I'm not sure if there were any yet at that time in 71, but what a shame. I mean, and I'm sure those studio executives maybe 5-10 years later were kicking themselves because that stuff started becoming very valuable, very collectible.
No kidding. Yeah. What a mistake that was later on. But
yeah, I mean, they destroyed, I don't know, maybe millions of dollars worth of collectible artwork, especially the cells.
I'm trying to get my hands on some Jerry Eisenberg cells. speaking of which, where did you come up with a lot of your ideas when you were tasked with an idea for a character or design or whatever?
That's one of your questions.
Was it always
my earliest contribution? Mm-hmm. Was probably in around 62 or so. There was a little lull in the work, and I had a few of my comic books in the studio. You know, for reference, I had a Roy Crane comic book called Wash Tubs. He's the one who did Captain Easy and Buzz Sawyer, if you know.
Oh yeah, name. Oh yeah, yeah.
Well, there was a character called Wash Tubs that was with Captain Easy, but then he had his own comic book a couple of times, and I had this one issue, and I'm looking through it, and they were like somewhere in Africa in a jungle area, and then I'm looking at this one panel. There's some bushes, and a hippo comes out from behind the bushes, just a normal hippo. And I thought, hey, maybe I'll design a hippo. We haven't done a hippo. You know, we have Yogi Bear, Quick Draw McGraw, Wally Gator and things, but nobody's done a hippo. So I designed a hippo standing up on two legs, and I put a pith helmet on him and a safari shirt. And I took these drawings to Joe, and he sparked for the idea and said, well, we'll get some writers together and let's develop it. And it became Peter Potamus. Yeah. I don't know if you've heard of Peter.
Of course, yeah. Yeah.
So that was my first creation for Joe, and I designed it. And then later on, I had another idea about teenagers. Nobody was doing a teenage show. So I did a bunch of drawings of, you know, like high school age, with a woody wagon, a surfboard sticking out, and the malt shop and everything. But he didn't spark to that. And I wasn't pushy about it. I was still so young, and I was in awe of him in those days.
Right, right.
But he made a mistake, unfortunately. You know, you should have given it a shot, because like 2 or 3 years later, I remember Filmation Studios came out with the show called The Archies, based on the comic book.
Yeah.
And that was all teenagers.
Absolutely.
Well, then he got interested. You know, then... And it took a while, but I think our first teenage show was probably Scooby-Doo. I can't remember right now if there was something before that.
Yeah, I'm trying to think because I'm thinking Josie, right, in the Pussycats.
That came right after Scooby, I think, around 1970, 71.
Okay, so that's after Scooby. All right.
Yeah.
Was there any other one? I'm trying to think. There's any other one. What about? It had to be after too. I'm thinking of the with the dune buggy that talked.
We did Speed Buggy. I think
that was after too.
I remember helping design some of the kids in that, and Evo designed some too. We designed a lot of characters, starting with. I'm trying to think. Well, there was my Peter Potamus.
Yeah.
And then I remember Ewo designed Secret Squirrel.
Oh, yeah.
And I think he designed Squiddly Diddly, if you remember those.
Oh, yeah, the octopus. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. He did a lot of nice characters. That was our specialty. And we did the Impossibles, and I remember designing the Space Cadets. And Young Frankenstein. We did a lot of design on that.
It seems like...
It was Frankenstein Jr. and The Impossible.
The Impossible.
Show.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. Oh, God, it brings back memories. And see, when was Yogi Berra? That was 50s, right? That was early.
Yeah, he was created and designed before I worked there, before either of us worked there.
Yeah.
I remember visiting Joe one night at their Chaplin studio, not long after they opened up there, and I think it was in 58 they came out with the Huckleberry Hound show with Yogi Berra in it. And I remember he was drawing some of the scripts in those days. He was doing a lot of writing. But, of course, you know, the first show was Rough and Ready, it was called.
Yes, yeah. Yep.
And then, boy, when Huckleberry Hound show hit, boy, that made a big splash.
Yep.
I remember Yogi Bear, Willie and I, you know, were working at Warner Brothers, and we were so taken with it, we kept walking around the studio. I was talking like Yogi, and Willie was talking about boo-boo, and we were making everybody crazy, especially Frizz Freeling.
Oh, God.
So I think Frizz was, these guys were always in competition with Joe, you know, over the years.
That's funny. So who reported to Bill and who reported to Joe?
Fortunately, the layout department was Joe's department.
Yeah, because I'd heard Bill was a little more, I don't know what the right word would be, just a little less lighthearted or less cheery as Joe was. More business.
He had a nice side to him, but then I didn't care to report. You know, there was things that disappointed me about him. Have you ever seen that site called Yowp, Y-O-W-P?
I have.
With Jim Benny?
Yeah.
Well, I had like about a 2.5-hour phone interview with him a few years back.
Yeah.
And it's all there, you know. There's like about 6 chapters. He put most of what we talked about. There's some stuff about Bill Hanna in there.
Yeah, I did want to listen to it all before I talked to you, because I wanted to, you know what I mean, I just wanted to go in unbiased and just, you know, but yes, I have it bookmarked and I'm like, okay, that was a lot of information there, it looked like. So
no, Bill was kind of he was a little too rough with people and sometimes rude. I always thought, he should have owned a shirt factory in Ireland or something.
Well,
but Joe was great, you know. It was good to be under his wing, and he had the writing department, the layout department, basically that. Those two departments were his.
Well, what I want to do here, if you don't mind, I want to read off a very abbreviated list of cartoons that you worked on or were involved with, and you could tell me whether or not you enjoyed it, didn't enjoy it, or anything like interesting tidbits about it.
Okay, and
I'll start with Quick Draw McGraw.
Yeah, I worked on that, but I didn't have anything to do with designing it or creating it. That was mostly, I think, Mike Maltese.
Okay,
that's what I heard.
All right,
but I loved the character. It was Baba Louie.
Yeah, yeah,
for sure. Yeah.
Okay, what about the Jetsons?
Oh, that was my favorite show of all the shows that I laid out on, because it was future. And, you know, that we didn't have any rules. Like, who knows what the future is going to be like, you know?
Right.
So from a design perspective, we could just use our imagination. And, I really enjoyed designing, you know, backgrounds and incidental characters and, of course, laying it out. And I remember Elo designed Astro the dog. He was a terrific character.
That was a great show. God, it was great.
I loved it. It probably was Tony's idea to have Astro sometimes walking along with George Jetson, and Astro would have his arm around George's shoulder.
Yeah.
So cute.
Yeah.
Yeah, I saved some cells.
You know,
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, Tony did that again. He did an episode, and I brought it up when I interviewed him because it was so. It just struck me as so funny. There's an episode of the Flintstones, which I'll bring up next. That he had he adopted this cat, and he's got at the end. You see him sitting on the stone sofa, so to speak, in front of the TV, and the cat's got his arm around Fred. It's hilarious. It's hilarious.
Yeah.
It's hilarious. And Wilma's having a fit.
Yeah, Tony came up with a lot of funny visual ideas, you know.
That's great.
Really cute stuff.
And what about the Flintstones? Was that a fun?
I loved work. I liked Flintstones. Maybe that was my second favorite in those days.
Did you ever?
On your list, you had Johnny. Okay, I'll wait for you to mention.
Oh, no, go ahead. I was going to say,
next one. Mentioned Johnny Quest was number four.
Right.
That was interesting. It was the first more of a realistic type show. It was nice to draw, you know, instead of always, my specialty is cartoony stuff, but I still like drawing more realistic characters once in a while.
Yep.
So Ewo and I and others helped develop the show, and we did what's called, they used to call it a Leica reel. We would illustrate every scene with one or two drawings, and then they'd be, the director, who was Nick Nichols, he would time everything out, and they would film the drawing. Let's say if the scene was supposed to be 5 seconds, they'd film that one drawing for 5 seconds. Sometimes we'd add a second or third drawing to give it a little more, not quite movement, but anyway, the Leica reel turned out very, very well, and I think it was Fred Silverman working at, I'm not sure if it was CBS then or ABC, and he bought the show. And then after it was animated, he didn't like the animation. He liked the Leica reel better.
Oh, really? Jeez.
Yeah, and another thing I remember, when they were trying to cast voices for the show, the coach, I can't remember the coach's name in the show, but we listened to a lot of tracks of the auditions, and there was one guy who did the funniest damn voice, and it was a little bit on the faggy side, the fey side.
Yeah.
I wish I could remember so I could imitate it, but we all laughed like hell, and of course the network chickened out. They didn't want that. They wanted something toned down a little bit. What a mistake, but it was the funniest voice.
Yeah.
I can't remember the voice guy's name, darn it.
I'll tell you what, I was in love with all the more of the cartoony style stuff in the 60s growing up, but Johnny Quest was the exception. I loved it, and I loved the music in it too. It was so neat. That thing was
It's funny, I'm not remembering the music. Ewo and I and a fellow named Lou Ott were a layout team on that. Like, you know, on the half-hour shows like Flintstones and Jetsons, they put three layout men together, and there'd be a team. Each of them, and the shows would have three acts, so we'd each do one act. Design incidental characters, do the character layouts and the background designs. And so that's how we worked on Johnny Quest, except Lou Ott, Ewell and I would rough out all the scenes, and Lou was the background designer. He did some beautiful background work.
Yeah, that was that reminds me. I hate to go backwards, but just with the Flintstones, who I noticed, if you notice, in a lot of them, they had the they'd have pink or purple palm trees and really wild colors, and that was really neat. You know,
I'm not quite remembering that. You know, I'm guilty of not watching a lot of the shows.
Well, yeah, you worked on it so much. Yeah,
I don't know what it was. I mean, I love the cartoons, but I guess I'm not as rabid a fan of that stuff like some of the guys that I worked with were, you know?
Yeah. Well, I'm sure
I was interested in other things too.
Right, of course, and you know, I'm sure at the end of the day, you know, you move on. It's like, okay, you know, you've done that all day long, you know, so it's like.
What I needed to do was go out to the movies sometimes and see a drama.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah.
Going down the list, it's The Secret Squirrel.
Yeah. Yeah, Ewell and I did layouts on that. There were other people working on it, but yeah. I do recall that Ewell designed Secret Squirrel.
Okay, okay. And what about, of course, Peter Potamus?
Well, that was my creation and design.
Yeah.
Of course, I never got a credit for it. I didn't think about it in those days.
Did you do the... did you design the sidekick with that little monkey, the monkey?
No, I didn't. You know, I've never been crazy about monkeys. I never saw a monkey that I really liked as far as the design until I really liked this Curious George that's on TV now.
Okay.
I think he's kind of appealing.
Yeah, okay, cool. Okay, but what about Super Friends?
Super Friends, I think we did some development work on that. I can't remember how much.
Yeah.
I never worked on production, though, like I did with the other shows.
Oh, you know,
on the different episodes.
Okay. And then there's...
I remember, of course, Alex Lovey... Alex Toth was responsible for a lot of the design work. And the incidental characters he designed, you know, for each episode.
Right.
You know where he really did some fabulous stuff was on the Johnny Quest series. That's when he first came to work there. Joe brought him in, and he did all the incidental, designed all the incidental characters for the 24 episodes or whatever.
Wow. Yeah, that was so
neat. I've got copies of that stuff. I did save some of his originals, and just... Oh, his work was terrific. He was really something.
I remember picking up the DVD collection of Johnny Quest, and I guess my memory didn't serve me well as a kid because I always thought it ran longer than it did, you know?
Huh.
And I got the DVD, and it said the complete series. And I'm like, what? That's it? You know, you're like, what? But every show they had were, you know, was fantastic. It was neat.
Yeah, it's really a shame. I don't know why. I never questioned or asked Joe why the network didn't want to renew it for another season or two. It was the same thing with the Jetsons. I was so disappointed when the network did not pick it up for a second season. Why? That's the trouble when you have the wrong kind of executives, you know, making these decisions that can't write or draw or not artistically inclined, they just make some dumb decisions.
Yeah, that makes zero sense. I don't understand that, you know.
The only exception, I loved working with Fred Silverman. He came around and started in 65, I think. I can't remember the first show that we were doing for him, but he was great. He was a cartoon fan, and he had a lot of respect for the artists and the writers, and... in fact, later on, when he became the president of NBC, he was probably the only top executive that would read Saturday morning scripts once in a while.
Wow. Wow. Yeah. That had to be good, though, having that guy in there. That's unusual.
No, he was good. I missed doing stuff with him.
And then what about Fang Face? Did you work on Fang Face? I thought you did.
Yeah, that's another character I created. That was when I left Hanna-Barbera to help Ruby Spears start up with their studio. And we started by doing a special. The lady from ABC brought over a book called The Puppy Who Wanted a Boy or something like that. It was a really charming story, and it made a nice special. Anyway, then we started kicking around ideas for, you know, a Saturday morning series. Because we had a really good deal with ABC. Before they started out, they were working for Fred Silverman, you know, inside ABC. And I used to help them on a freelance basis with their developments. But Fred gave them his blessing to start their own studio. So, and what ABC did, they negotiated a deal where they guaranteed us one half-hour show if we stay exclusive with them. We don't present anything to the other two networks. In those days, there were still only three networks.
Mm-hmm.
So we knew we had a show. We just had to develop ideas and find out what it's going to be. And the man at ABC we were dealing with for Saturday morning, was his name was Squire Rushnell. I remember the day he came over to the studio and we showed him maybe two, three ideas that we liked the best. One was my Fang Face. Another was a prehistoric group. And I don't remember if we had a third one. And so Squire was nice. He didn't choose what he wanted. He said, you guys decide. So, of course, I voted for my Fang Face.
Right.
And all I needed was one more vote, either Ken or Joe's vote. But fortunately, they all liked Fang Face, so we did Fang Face.
There you go.
And
excellent.
That's but and then the next year, ABC wanted to keep us exclusive, so they guaranteed us two shows, 2 half-hours. They ended up buying 4 half-hours from us that year. But we really had to scramble to get enough people to get it done.
Mm. Wow.
But that was exciting.
So would that be, I know this kind of goes ahead a little bit with questioning, but the
yeah.
As far as, I know a lot of you guys hate to sit there and say, well, my favorite was, but if you had a favorite of all the things you have, were involved with, all the projects and characters, what would that probably be?
Well, I might still have to stay with the Jetsons.
Jetsons, yeah.
And of course, my Fang Face character.
Yeah.
I don't know. I think those are my two favorites. I liked a lot of shows, but mostly I think Jetsons number one, and of course the Flintstones for sure.
Yeah. Hey, did you meet? I meant to ask you this too. Did you ever meet some of the voice talent for the Flintstones and the other shows when you were? Did they ever just show up, or did you see them? And,
I remember meeting Alan Reed sometimes when he'd be coming in. He'd come into the. We had a coffee room there, and then he'd make his way to Joe's office or something.
Yes, I was just wondering. So I had heard Alan Reed was just a great guy, and
he was. He looked like Fred Flintstone too.
I know. I remember seeing a picture of him going, "Oh my God, that's the perfect, perfect voice actor for Fred. He looks like him."
I wish some of us would have tried to hang around with him a little bit just to hear what he had to say.
Yeah, that's funny. Speaking of which,
he was terrific, and of course Dawes Butler, the great Dawes Butler, he was terrific.
Oh yeah,
and Don Messick. Later on, there was Paul Lind. I forget a lot of the names. Anyway, I'm getting ahead of ourselves.
Yeah. No. So. That's kind of a good segue into kind of going back a little bit. So I had heard from Tony said that you and him had brought some cameras to the office, or the studio.
Yeah, Tony started, he had an 8mm Bolex, and he was taking, movie films around the studio. So I'd already bought, I started collecting cameras a little bit back then, not much, but I had a 8mm Bolex also. So I started bringing mine in and filming people around the studio. And we do little scenes of, gag stuff and then just straight stuff. And I did that for a few years. And what I did, I remember I borrowed Tony's films and took mine and had them eventually transferred onto VHS,
right,
and then later on the VHS to DVD. But what I can't figure out is I was doing all this between 1964 and 67, and Tony was in there too, maybe started a little bit before, but I don't know why I stopped, because the first time I left the studio was in 75, which was like, almost 8 years later.
Right.
I stopped bringing my movie camera in, but I always had my still camera. I took a lot of still pictures over those 8 years, too. But I'm so disappointed I didn't do more movie film, because I never did get around to filming Barbera and Hannah and several other people.
Huh. Yeah, but at least you've got some record of it, though. That of you know of the.
I'm glad. You know, we got a lot of fun stuff. I remember I showed Joe Barbera the VHS one day, and he asked for a copy, so I had a copy made for him. And the stuff exists. The studio, well, now they belong to Warner Brothers, but it's in their archives.
Yeah, how neat is
but
that?
It's mine and Tony's film. It doesn't belong to Warner Brothers.
Yeah, that's that's fantastic, though. That's cool.
Yeah.
Love to see that.
Yeah, I'm so glad we did it. And I used to film not only in color, but sometimes I'd buy some black and white film, and that stuff looks pretty good in black and white too.
Yeah, I bet. It's too bad they didn't have. I don't imagine yours. I mean, it's too bad they didn't have audio. You know what I mean?
Oh, you're right. Yeah.
God, could you imagine?
I can't remember when some of the 8mm cameras came out with audio, but we didn't have it at that time.
Yeah, I don't think anybody did. So, or most of us didn't. But that's neat.
If only we would have had video cameras, but those came, I forget, those didn't come in until, I don't know, somewhere in the 70s.
Yeah, I know. That's just the way it is, you know.
What a shame. And then, of course, there's so many people that I didn't film. I'm not sure. I think Mike Maltese was still around, but he worked at home, you know. So I guess on the days I brought it in, he wasn't there, you know.
Yeah.
It's a shame. I missed him and Warren Foster besides Joe and Bill.
Huh.
And Howard Hansen. Maybe I got Howard. But
As far as I know, a lot of artists and designers have their own favorite preferences as far as tools and pencils and stuff.
Yeah.
Did you have any or did you just grab what you had or the studio supplied you with stuff?
Well, they supply us with, I had certain pencils I liked. There was one called Blackwing, and then there was a brown pencil called Drafting.
Huh.
I can remember those two. And, of course, I went to visit some of my cartoon friends who were working at the UPA studios in Burbank. You know, that's the studio that did Mr. Magoo and stuff like that.
Yes, oh yeah, yeah.
And I go over there. This was probably, again, in the early 60s. And I saw they were working with these little marking, color markers called Magic Marker. I'd never seen them before.
Yeah.
And they were using them to color stuff with. And I thought, wow, this stuff is great. So I went back to the studio and I went to see Joe. And I said, Joe, can we get some of these Magic Markers? I explained what they were. And he said, sure. So I took a purchase order down to some art store and bought a bunch of them, some for me and for Iwo and whoever else. And we started using those. And then others came out, like Design Marker and Ad Marker. Great stuff to work with.
Yep. I've used the Ad Markers. They were great.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've still got a bunch of those. But I had fun for my background designs. I used to take some of these erasers and I'd carve out with a razor blade or a X-Acto knife a shape of, say, a flower or a leaf. And I'd get an ink pad and I'd use the eraser thing as a stamp and I'd stamp all these designs of leaves. Just gave it a look.
Yeah, that's cool.
And a funny story that I'm recalling, the head of our camera department, his name was Frank Paker. He had been at MGM with Joe and a lot of the key guys. In those days, in 61, 62, we were always doing what's called a three-field repeat background. It would be, if you're familiar with a sheet of animation paper, that's
right.
Like one field
right.
With the holes punched in it.
Yep.
So you take you'd have a long piece that would be like three of those. It'd be called a three-field. And so we would design the middle and one side, but let's say it's the left side.
Right.
That would be repeated over on the right side. It would just save a lot. You wouldn't design all three fields. And that's why you'll notice in the old cartoons how you'll keep seeing the same building or tree. When a character is running, it keeps repeating.
Yes, yeah.
And so after a while, And I said, I'm tired of doing these three field repeats. I'd like to lengthen the middle section a bit. Like, I figured out it could still work if I lengthen it a half a field, make it 1.5 fields in the middle and one field on each end. And so I went to Nick Nichols, our animation director, and he was from Disney, and, you know, they didn't do those cheap three field repeats.
Yeah.
So he said, yeah, good idea. Let's do that. So the first time Frank Paker received the new background with the like it was a 3.5 field background, he called me up and he's raising hell. I said, listen, Frank, it works. Nick Nichols like it. Check with him if you like. I think I even checked it out with Joe Barbera in advance. So then the funny thing is we started lengthening the backgrounds. The next step was like a 4-field. And then it went finally to 5-field repeat. So you'd have 3 fields in the middle and a repeat field on each end. And the funny, I heard later on after we were doing that, that Frank Paker, he would get mad if anything shorter came in.
That's great.
Oh, God, that's funny.
It's, you know, everybody's resistant to change in the beginning, you know.
Yeah.
Until
yeah.
you see the value, they're like, okay, you know. But, yeah, I remember.
I was thinking artistically. I mean, it was right. not satisfying doing just, you know, a 3-field repeat. It just was, once we got to 4 and 5 fields, that was more satisfying.
But I will tell you that. I know when you look back on it, like when I look back on watching some of those shows, it adds to the charm, though, and the character of those shows, you know?
That's true. Yeah, there's that factor.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and as a little kid, you don't really see it as much. I'm sure at some point I'm like, hey, I just saw that building, you know, see it again. But at some point, it was such a, I guess you would say, insignificant part of it, if you're looking at it from the producer's eyes, I guess, you know, and then, you know, you're looking at the foreground more or less, so it's like, who cares about the background? But I see your point artistically. Oh, it made it much better to add
artistically. I just wanted to do more design work, you
right.
know, have a little more fun with it.
Yeah, no doubt. That's
so the norm became 5 fields. eventually.
It seems to me, though, just from talking to a lot of you guys, that Hanna-Barbera was all about efficiency. I mean, you made the most out of every drawing, it seems like to me.
True. You know? But you know who went further with that was Lou Scheimer at Filmation, his studio.
Right,
you know,
they
did what's called a lot of stock scenes. They would reuse a lot of stuff. Maybe some of their episodes would have, maybe 1/3 of the scenes were from previous shows, you know, so he'd save a lot of money by doing that. But that was, I don't know, I don't think that was very satisfying. A little bit is okay.
Yeah, a little bit. Now, I mean, Hanna-Barbera had, you had that one show called Laugh Olympics or something. It had to be a gold mine because your characters were already done, right? You didn't have to redesign new characters pretty much.
That's true.
You know,
Todd, I wasn't there at that time. You know, that was one of the two times I was away. I forget which one they did that. Yeah, Laugh Olympics. I remember hearing that Fred Silverman wanted to call it the Schmo-Olympics. But he got talked out of that.
Oh, God. Yeah.
Then they called it the Laugh Olympics.
Well, didn't I heard somewhere that the Slag Brothers, the design from the Slag Brothers, turned into Captain Caveman? Is that right? Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
Yeah, there was some, I did some freelance work for Joe and Ken when they were working in with Fred at ABC, and one of the shows was something about teen angels or something, and I designed all these girls. They were like, almost like superhero girls. They could do different, you know, one could be like Plastic Girl or Plastic Man. And another one had certain powers, and it was a fun thing to develop and design. And then Fred, he liked it. He took it over to Hanna-Barbera. I'm not sure if it was his idea or Joe's or maybe Ken and Joe to do this, add this caveman to them, you know?
Yeah, it seemed.
What I heard was they used the Slag, one of the Slag brothers, and Ewo just put a cape on him, and they gave him this big club that he carried. Well, they had a, I think in Wacky Races they had clubs.
Yep, they did. Oh, yeah.
They just, the only change to the character was he made the nose longer or something like that.
Yeah, and they didn't talk much, and I don't think the Steig brothers, other than they beat each other on the head with a club.
Yeah.
There wasn't a lot of dialogue going on there, but I don't remember how much Captain Caveman talked either. I mean, there, you know, but
I can't remember. I hope I saw one or two episodes, but I can't remember for sure.
Yeah. Oh, by the way, I wanted to tell you, are you aware that those original pencils that you're talking about, the black wings, go for a pretty penny?
I happen to see an article somewhere,
they brought them. They still make them. I mean, the company brought them back as Palomino, I guess, makes them now, and I own a bunch of them. But the originals, they'll go for like $100 plus a pencil on eBay.
What?
Yeah.
For one pencil?
Yeah, I've seen that. I've seen them go as high as like $85 to $100 for a pencil, and sometimes maybe a pair of them. That's it. Yeah.
Still got maybe four or five of them in the original box, but I don't have a complete dozen.
Oh, jeez.
Well, that I was used them.
Well, do you still? I was going to ask you, do you still draw in your spare time? Do you ever just find yourself drawing a lot? I mean, just
I do.
Yeah.
Not as much as I'd like to, but over the years I've designed and developed my own ideas. I've got a bunch of folders full of ideas and drawings, and then of course I do other cartoons for family and friends and or somebody's kid. Yeah. I like doing that, and I'm still doing a little work for pay. There's a startup company. They started up back about almost 5 years ago now, called Meacham Media.
And
it's a father and son team. And the father, Charles Meacham, he's really a nice fellow. He used to be the CEO at Taft Broadcasting when they bought Hanna-Barbera back in 68.
Huh, wow.
So I've been doing character design and development work for them off and on for almost 5 years. You know, I haven't done a lot in the last couple of years. I'm doing a lot more stuff, my own things, but
yeah.
I like to keep my hand in it.
Well, what do you
I
think?
I still like to draw.
Well, what do you think about today's all the software technology that's out there now? I mean, have you seen some of that? It's for animation.
I have. It's amazing what's being done. You know, it's quite impressive. The only thing is I still am more interested in working with pen and pencil.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah. I'm not interested in even the storyboarding, you know. I was doing a lot of storyboarding work maybe in the starting, I forget when. Well, even back at Hanna-Barbera in the late 60s, but I was able to work in pencil. I guess if I still wanted to do some for some of the studios, they'd probably let me do work in pencil on the storyboard paper. But nowadays, the storyboard guys are using some type of a computer called Cintiq. Have you heard of that one?
Oh, yeah. Yes. Yeah, I've got a Cintiq, I guess you'd say, alternative. And I also draw on in fact, I've got a freelance project I'm working on now that's I've been doing 100% digitally on a tablet. It's called a motion tablet, but I'll be honest with you. I still like drawing on paper because it's just I need that a little bit of that. I don't know what you want to call it, drag or that tactile feeling, the resistance. You can't draw slow. It's hard to draw slow on glass.
I can't see designing a character on a computer screen. I don't know.
It's hard. I'll design some. Like I'm trying to work on some character developments now. I'm working on one that I'm particularly interested in. I'll sketch it on the tablet in a program called Sketchbook Pro, and then but then I always find myself going back to the drawing board and with pencil and graphite and paper, and that's where I guess that's just where I was I was raised. You know, I mean, it's what I'm used to.
Same here, yeah. I'm not really old-fashioned. I'm just comfortable using those kind of tools.
Right.
I guess if I was younger and I wasn't semi-retired, if I had to work full-time again, I'd have to learn that kind of stuff.
Right. Yeah, you're almost forced.
Maybe not.
I think that, to me, it's just another tool. It's just another tool. And some will love it. I've got some buddies that swore by it. And now you talk to them and they're like, you know what? I one day I just started picking up the pencil and I realized, man, I missed that so much. So it's just another tool. It's just whatever your preference is, you know?
That's right. Yeah.
You know?
I'm sure we're not alone in that thinking, but,
no.
It is amazing what can be done with the computers though. It's quite impressive, but
right. You still got to have the ability to draw though. You know what I mean? It can't do that. So it's,
The initial creation, I think, you know, like if you're creating a character or characters, I think you can still do that with pencil and pen. And then
right.
It gets, they scan it into the computer or something.
Right, right.
I'm not real. I have a computer and I have a cell phone, but it's more of a basic cell phone. So I tell people I still have one foot in the Stone Age, but I'm comfortable.
Yeah.
You know.
But see, You and a bunch of guys, you predicted all this with the Jetsons, so, you know, you're responsible for this. Yeah,
yeah, so. It's interesting. Oh, I'll tell you another little story about the Jetsons development. One day, Tony, he came in and he showed me a book that he found for research for the development. It was titled 1975. And of course, this was 1962 when we're developing the show. But it showed all these things that there were, you know, designers and scientists were predicting would come by the 70s. And it was a great book. I eventually found myself a copy about 5 years ago. I used to look for it off and on, and I finally found it.
That's cool. That's cool.
13. And another thing, another inspiration, I had an architecture book. I used to collect a lot of art books and architecture and stuff like that. I had a book by this architect, Oscar Niemeyer. He was from Brazil. And I had this book, and he had such beautiful buildings he designed and models. And it fitted right in with the Jetson idea. You know, he designed certain walkways and things. And some of that stuff I took inspiration from, you know, and made variations on it, you know. I didn't want to copy it outright, but that was very helpful. Very, very helpful.
And you know what's funny is that somebody like my son, who's 15 or even younger, they could probably sit down, watch the Jetsons, and it would probably fit right in with today. They would look at it as being antiquated, you know? Be like, yeah,
I know.
Okay. That's normal.
It's interesting. It's like a timeless thing. It just transcends. I can't think of the other words I want, but it's still, what's the word, timely or timeless?
Timeless, yeah. It is. It really is. It's funny. You know, because
I wish I could remember who came up with a lot of the ideas. You know, Joe might have contributed some, but the writers and sometimes us layout men would contribute ideas, or even sometimes I'd come up with an idea for a piece of dialogue. And Joe was funny. He'd look at me and say, "Hey, I'm the writer."
Yeah, that you had a lot, but you guys had, it seemed like you guys were just like one big family that you all contributed, you know?
Yeah, because some of us, you know, like Ewo and myself or another, you know, we, besides designing, you know, we could come up with premise ideas, you know, even some of the dialogue, you know, we would contribute that way too.
Yeah, that had to be a great time. What, I'm glad you brought up references and everything, because I know a lot of young artists probably are intimidated, like, oh my God, I have to draw out of my head. I can't. It's like I don't know about you, but I mean, some stuff I can, but most of it I swear by references. I mean, I just, not necessarily copy, but to get ideas. And sometimes, like with women, this freelance job I have now is dealing with drawing women. And I'll be honest with you, I don't draw women that well. I do more cartoony style, and And I could do cartoony women. They want more like even a little bit beyond Archie, like Veronica style. And I'm like, okay, yeah. I need some references here, you know? And
sure.
And I don't consider that cheating. It's like I've got to get these poses right. Yeah, so, you know, and...
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
You know, I learned a lot from Iwo because he was so good at drawing girls and women. You know, he did a lot of that at Disney, you know, working on some of the features. They used to give him a lot of the females to clean up. You know, he was an assistant, a key assistant animator.
Yep. That's just...
But, and then I developed my own... techniques with that, but I did. It was very helpful working with Iwo in the early years. You know, I learned a lot watching him, seeing his stuff.
Yeah.
But
yeah, I have reference books all over the place. All over. I mean, I just.
Oh, I always assume, you know, most artists and cartoonists, you need that. You know.
Yeah.
You know, if I was trying to design some characters or. Working on a concept, if I'd sort of have a all of a sudden I'd blank out. Nothing was happening, you know. I wasn't able to think of anything. Well, I would sometimes look through some books, not always art books, but say a book on old movie serials and stuff like that.
Yeah.
And maybe I'd see one character or see some kind of a prop that would just all of a sudden trigger an idea. And I used to sit in front of the television with a drawing pad and pencils, and something would be said, or I'd see an image of something or a character, and all of a sudden that would spark an idea, and then I'd get started that way.
Yeah.
I don't know if you've done that, but that used to work for me some of the time.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. You just never know. I'll get it sometimes while I'm driving. Looking at a billboard or something, you know?
Like, oh, yeah.
My wife
thinks... Exactly, a billboard or somebody walking on the street that has a funny look or whatever. I don't know.
Yeah, and my wife just thinks I'm nuts. But, I mean, I'm like, oh, well, you know, so I am. But, yeah, I Google a lot. You can go to Google Images now and just, like, one of the things I'm working on now is this little silly creature... It's a swamp monster, whatever, but it's a cute style, you know, cartoony.
Yeah.
And I'll Google stuff like the bayou, swamp, whatever, and just come up with images just to get ideas. Like, okay, here's the atmosphere. Yeah. Here's the world that he lives in. This will work, you know, that kind of a thing. But
yeah.
I remember Tony said something that made a lot of sense. He said, look, if you're having trouble with, say, drawing a woman, grab a, you know, whatever it is, print it off from the computer or get a catalog or magazine, whatever, trace it. He said, trace it and trace it and trace it again. Keep tracing it. He says, don't use that as your final, but trace it so many times so that you understand the way everything, you know, is laid out.
All
and
right.
He says, before you know it, you won't need to trace it, but you'll be able to look at it, you know, refer to it and move on because you'll get used to it, the way the body moves, the way the body... is positioned and all, you know, it's just stuff like that, little tips and tricks that, you know, that work in the end, you know?
Yeah, that's nice. Yeah. I hadn't heard him mention that before, but that sounds good.
Yeah. You know, yeah. I don't trace that much because I just happen to like, especially with my tablet, the nice thing about it is you can quickly, you know, hit clear and it erases it. So I'll just sketch by looking at something and the first 20 look like crap, so then I'll do it again, and then finally, okay, this looks respectable, and then I keep building it, layer it, and layer it, you know, until it looks like something I want. Like, I imagine when you're trying to come up with a hippo standing on 2 feet, you know, it's no different. I mean, you're like, okay, you got to start with a real hippo, right? I mean, that's how you move on.
I don't know if I saved any of my early rough drawings of that, you know, but I guess you do different versions, and you know, like sometimes, like with Fang Face, for instance, the first design I made of Fang Face, then I did many other versions, you know, variations.
Right.
But we always came back to the first one, so that was a surprise. It doesn't always work that way, but once in a while, you come back to everybody likes the first one.
Yeah, that's cool.
And that's like, it's not always like that.
Right. Yeah. That sounds like Yeah, it's just really good to know how other designers, you know, come up with their ideas and how they start and finish.
And like with young people that sometimes be visiting the studio, or if you'd meet, if I'd be with another family and they'd have a teenager that was interested in cartooning and drawing, and I used to advise them, well, get that Walter T. Foster book on cartooning, animation.
Yeah.
And just copy a lot of the poses, but then at some point, make up your own poses, you know, and design your own, you know, change the face, make up your own face on the character and whatever clothing it has, you know.
That's like the Bible.
I used to like doing props. You know, I liked always, if I design a character, I wanted to have something on him that would be a little different, like a certain kind of hat or a hairdo, or maybe just a belt or a vest.
Right.
And make the vest different, you know?
Yep. I always felt like with that Walter Foster book, by the way, that's like the Bible. That's the best. I have that. That was one of my earliest acquisitions, you know? But I always felt like when I'm designing a character, and of course, I obviously don't have the success that you did, but I always think about the silhouette. Make it so that the silhouette would be interesting, you know. So come up with something, like you said, a hat, a collar, something that stands out, so that when you have a silhouette of that character, you look at it and go, instantly, you know, that's who that is. Because you
that's a good idea. Very good.
You know, it's just a strong, you know, it stands out. Make their character strong. Something about it that's just different, you know, in his profile, whatever.
Absolutely.
But
even when whoever, it was probably Ed Benedict who designed Yogi Bear originally, and he put that cute hat and a collar and a tie on him.
Right.
You know, just a little touch like that.
Yeah. It makes it work. Unfortunately for me, I didn't get into the animation industry like I wish I had growing up. So I'm in graphic design now, but I do cartooning on the side. So you know, I'm trying. I just wish I had those, you know, that connection built up. But now, being that I'm 51 years old, it's probably over for me. So, you know.
Oh no!
I feel like I'm washed up. But
I hope not. No, I don't. You shouldn't be.
Yeah.
Gosh, that's still pretty young.
I mean,
like 60 is the new 40, so you're like, your 50 is like the new 30.
Hey, I like that attitude. That's great. That's good. Yeah.
You know, when you talk about the silhouette and props, that reminds me of a show we developed for Fred Silverman for 2 or 3 years. It was called The Four Yo-Yos in Space. And these four funny guys. And I remember designing them, and Ewo was in, I think he might have designed one of the characters, I'm not sure, but Joe Barbera and his writers could never get the outline to where Fred Silverman liked it, you know, the idea of the show and some story ideas. So we fooled around with it for like 2 or 3 years. We would present it to him. And one time when he was first there, the first year, he was meeting with Joe in his office, and I'm back in my cubicle drawing like crazy. I still had some ideas. So I made a design of this one guy. Made me think of the guy in the Three Stooges with the bald head.
Yeah, Curly. Yeah.
I decided I'd make him bald headed, and I had him standing with he was wearing a sweatshirt where the sleeves were cut off, and then I had him in these boxer shorts, you know, like underwear with red hearts all over them. And some, I used to like to put saddle shoes on the character because I used to like to wear those kind of shoes. So, and then what I thought of something to put on his head. I was thinking, what kind of a hat? And I thought of a toilet plunger. So I put the plunger on his head. And I went up to Joe's secretary and said, would you bring this in to Joe and Fred? And she did. And Fred loved it. That became one of the characters. And he called it. It was so funny. I heard that he said, it looks like a Polish astronaut.
God. Oh, Jesus. That's funny. Oh, man. Yeah.
So those things would happen. And, you know, you get these, you never know when you're going to get the inspiration. But
yeah. That's a great story.
We never sold the show, darn it. It was a huge show. I did a lot of development work on it and big setups and never sold.
Yeah.
Someday.
Yeah, it's too bad. You know, you hear there's probably a lot that sitting somewhere is on the shelf, you know?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of things that never sold.
That you wonder. Yeah. Well, it's a shame.
Like wacky submarines, I think that could maybe be viable, but who knows?
Yeah. Well, now there's like, I don't know, there's hardly anything anymore. I mean, they got rid of Saturday morning stuff. I mean, it's...
That's right.
That's sad to me. And it's kind of... Well, my wife and I were talking about that with my son because these kids today, I say it like I'm really old, but the generation today, they have so many, the resources are so vast for their entertainment. Where what do we have? We had radio and we have what, three or four channels in the beginning, you know, early on. So kids, a lot of the kids in the 60s, like myself, we grew up watching the same stuff. There weren't, you know. So you have it was just great memories, and now it's like it's just scattered, it's homogenized, and I don't know where they go. I mean, I look at the Boomerang channel, and that's only so I can get some of the old stuff. Otherwise, I got to buy DVDs, you know, and I don't always have time to pop that in. So it's just kind of lost. I don't know what the studios are going to do, but other than movies, you know. But
I wonder if it's possible that someday the things could kind of turn around or recycle back to the way it was. I don't know.
Yeah, I don't either. I understand things change, and I understand that. I don't, you know, but it just seems kind of sad. But, I mean, they have stuff for the little kids that are really, you know, young that are coming up. They have channels for them. But, you know, I don't know. So I really support, like, every so often you'll see one try to make it, whether it's on Cubo or some strange, you know, different channel. I always feel like it's like, God, you know, it's kind of behooves us to support those productions. But anyway, so I guess on that note, if you had any advice for, you know, young artists today, you know.
Oh, yeah, that was one of your questions. That's... that's a little difficult. I don't know. I'm just not sure. I don't know. Like me, whenever I would do development work or designing characters, whether it was for Joe or some other studio, I always did quite a variety, you know, because there were some fellas in the business that they would spend a few days or a week trying to design a character. They'd come in. I remember Joe and Ken, when they were working at the Patty Freeling, they went there for a while, and they were developing. And I used to do some moonlighting for them. You know, I'd help develop some stuff for them. But there was one in-house artist there. He was a very good cartoonist and artist. But they'd say he'd spend 5 days or so, and he'd come in with one drawing. And they'd say, well, do you have anything else? But I could never work that way. I would just bombard them with, you know, give them plenty of different variations and choices. But that's how I chose to work. And it helped because I was fast, you know. I could draw very fast.
Yeah, that's really good.
And that was another thing. There's you could read this in Yelp, too, about Bill Hanna. Dan Gordon was working at the studio, and he was an old-timer from New York. He'd worked with Joe and my father back in New York, and he was very good. He was kind of an idea man. Like when we were developing the Jetsons, he did a lot of sketches and put down a lot of ideas for that series. In fact, this man Ken Platt, who was my father's good friend, he worked at Hanna-Barbera for a while, and one day he gave me a couple of envelopes full of Dan's drawings. And I said, yeah, I'd love to save those. And what I was going to say is Dan had two sons, and his oldest son, Kevin, could draw, and Dan had him come in to meet with Bill Hanna about getting hired, you know, if there was a chance to get a job. And so Bill was interested in hiring him, but he took him over to his bookkeeper. It was, we just had one building we worked in. Nobody had any windows. It was like a bunker. It was before they built their studio in Cahuenga. He had her look up my records and a couple of others, like how much work does Jerry do? How many scenes does he lay out on average? And because Kevin had said, how much work do you expect? How many scenes do you expect me to do each week? So, and that wasn't fair. That really, I thought that was shitty, you know, because he should have had her look at several different people in layout and get an average of what the output was, how many scenes a week on average. But he just had her check on me because I used to, Iwo and I were probably did the most, and even Willie Ito, we could turn out a lot of scenes. And that wasn't fair, though, that he did that. Now, that I didn't like at all. Dan was all pissed off. I remember he came by our cubicle and he told me about it. And I said, yeah, that's pretty crummy.
Yeah, that's...
But there was things that Hannah did that I just didn't care for. There's a lot more than that. But
Yeah. Well, I
guess... I preferred working with Joe. Maybe he was no angel either, but no, he was... He was nicer, you know, more of a gentleman.
Yep.
And he was a hell of a good cartoonist himself.
Yeah, that's what I understood. That's helpful too. That you've got a boss that can draw, right? I mean.
Yeah. Well, even when I worked at Warner Brothers, Chuck Jones, I thought he was I loved his cartoon work, and you know, I could stop by his office. His office was in the middle of the unit, and you know, some of us were on one side, and the other guys were on the other side. And I could stop in, and he would start showing me a lot of stuff. He was like a teacher, because I think he had gone to Chouinard Art Institute at one time himself.
So, if you had to pick an individual along the way, your career path that was probably the most impactful for you, to your career, who might that be?
Yeah, I can name you several people. Chuck Jones, Abe Levito, Mike Maltese, Maurice Noble, who was the layout man for Chuck. Holly Pratt was Frizz Freeling's layout man. Boy, he was terrific. He also illustrated some of the children's books, you know, like the golden books. And the large ones and small ones. And my father was doing the same stuff, but Holly had such a great style. If you could ever find his Quick Draw McGraw book, and he did a Flintstone one. And I think Quick Draw, Flintstone, and there was something else, which I'm forgetting. Then, of course, Iwo Takamoto, Willie Ito, a Japanese fellow that worked with us named Takashi, Alex Toth, and Tony Benedict. Probably leaving off a few.
That's quite a list, though, some top talents there.
Who am I leaving off? Oh gosh,
that's a lot of people. It just proves one thing: you get, you know, everybody gets help along the way. You know.
Oh yeah, you get inspired. You see what somebody else is doing, and
right? You feed feed off of each other. Yeah.
Yeah. It's great. Unfortunately, you know, some people maybe have an ego where they won't admit that or. Some people never give out any compliments. I guess they can be very competitive or something.
Yeah, there was one question I had forgotten to ask you, Jerry. Do you remember what it felt like to receive a decent salary for, you know, your talent? That had to be kind of exciting.
Well, when I started at MGM as an apprentice in betweener, well, in those days, you know, I think I started at $49 a week. It wasn't very much, but of course the cost of living wasn't that high. I was living at home, at my mother's home, so I didn't have to pay rent or anything.
Wow, so yeah, that's...
$49. I thought some of the guys who were single and living on their own, that was probably a little rough on them. But
Well, I guess this. I guess one question that comes from that stems from that. I guess I should probably ask too is when you're at Hanna-Barbera and some of these other studios, even MGM and Warner Brothers. What was like the day like? When did your day end? Did you have a normal work day? What was it like? Did you like get in there at 6 or 7 and get out of there at, you know, weird hours, or were there set hours and then you had overtime? I mean, I know you're part of a union, so how did that all work for you?
Well, there was overtime. There wasn't, I don't remember doing much of that at Warner Brothers. Warner Brothers had a time clock, which nobody liked, but at Hanna-Barbera, there were no time clocks. But there was always extra work. There was always overtime work on the weekends. And, of course, working on a Saturday and Sunday, the union rule was you'd get paid double time. So, you know, we could work maybe 20 hours, like 2 10-hour days, and get a whole extra week's pay. It was great.
Wow.
But they weren't really paying us that generously. You know, I think we all felt we were being underpaid. But I remember one time Bill Hanna asked Evil and I if we'd lay out some Kellogg's commercials for him, you know, for the studio. And he was paying us, these were like 1 minute commercials. And I remember the pay was $250, which, it was okay.
Yeah.
Because it didn't take us long to do the layouts, made it worthwhile. But then Willie, who was working in the next door cubicle to us, he said, oh, he's been doing commercials down the street for Filmfare Studios, which mainly does commercials. And he said, I've laid out some Kellogg's commercials there, and I get paid $600.
Oh, jeez.
I thought, God damn, that Hannah's really fizzling. So I said to Evo, let's go in and meet with Hannah and say, you know, we'll tell him what we heard about Filmfare and say, you know, we'd like to get paid more, maybe not that much, because Hannah had a much larger overhead. But I say, you know, how about paying us $400 or $450 or something? But Evo didn't want to do it, unfortunately.
Oh, he's
afraid of rocking the boat. But, you know, we were Joe's guys. You know, I don't know what they're... I wasn't afraid of Hannah.
What if you go back, I've noticed there's some old commercials that were really bizarre. There were some like with the Flintstones pushing cigarettes and did those? Who was responsible for those?
I don't know. See, because when I went to work there full time, it was during the second season for the Flintstones. So that all happened, I think, in the first season.
Okay. Yeah, they were.
I didn't ask about it. Maybe I didn't know about it at first, but I never bothered to, you know, check it out or ask questions. I wish I would have done more of that.
Yeah, I was wondering, because there's some that are out there that are like, one was for Winston. I think one was for Welch's Grape Jelly. There was a bunch. They were black and white, though, so it had to be early, like you said.
Yeah, I'm surprised most TVs were still black and white. But I think on even Hanna-Barbera, they still did their stuff in color because they figured later on there might be color TVs, you know?
Hmm. Yeah.
In fact, I think there already were some color TVs in use. I think that started maybe in the late 50s or mid-50s.
Unfortunately, we didn't have one. We didn't get one until a little bit later. We had it. I mean, we had it in late 60s. We had them, but we had it, our family. Yeah. But, yeah, that was, I just found that was interesting. There was a bunch. There was a bunch with Yogi Bear cereal commercials and somewhere. Kellogg's, I think, was a big one.
I can't remember the characters we used to do for this, but Kellogg's was big on the commercials.
And I used to love, did you like the iconic style that UPA had? I thought that was pretty neat.
I did. I liked it very much. You know, that was very refreshing, you know. Just terrific. Yeah, no, I was quite taken with that.
Yeah. I thought that was, I liked their stuff.
Because I used to go over and visit some of the guys at UPA. That's where I discovered the magic markers. And what's interesting, you know, at Disney, they were still, you know, pretty much doing traditional-looking stuff. But they decided to do something in the modern style, kind of like UPA. So it was that animator, the director, Ward Kimball. I don't know if you ever saw this, but it was about a 15 or 20 minute short called Toot, Whistle, Plunk, and Boom. It is so terrific. The design is beautiful. It's almost like a UPA thing, but in their style, and very successful. I think it won an Academy Award.
I'd have to look back. I'm not recalling it. I'll have to.
I would get on Google and just type that in and see what comes up. There might be some video clips from it or something. Maybe you can see the whole thing.
I'll have to look that up. I just remember, speaking of Disney, the one, believe it or not, of all the things they've done, which some are, they've done beautiful stuff, but the one I remember the most, and it was because the style was different. It was the 101 Dalmatians. The art was different. I guess they Xeroxed it, right? And it had a rough look to it, but it had that. Yeah. I don't know how to describe the style, but the backgrounds were really, really neat.
And, I heard that. Yes, and I like that very much too. Yeah.
Yeah.
And I've seen some of the illustrations in some of the Disney books I have. Yeah.
Yeah, it separates itself from all the other ones they've done. I don't think they ever went back to that, but I really like that. That was really neat.
There should have been more stuff done like that. You're right.
Yeah. But
and it's too bad they only did that Toot, Whistle, Plunk one. It's only one time, but they just wanted to say, hey, we can do this. Modern stuff.
Yeah. And you're almost like, why don't you? You know? Why don't you do more of it? Yeah. It's too bad.
But I hope you can see that or see parts of it. It was really terrific.
Yeah. I will seek it out for sure. I will definitely look at it, look for it. So,
Oh, there's one obscure character that I created when we were doing developing a show where Joe had a buzzard. He was called Blast Off Buzzard, and he was chasing a rabbit. And it was in a desert type climate. And he went to the network with whatever drawings we supplied him with, and he came back and said, they're not interested. So then when he left, I sat down at my desk and I thought, what else is in the desert that the buzzard could chase? I started thinking of, what was it? Lizard, other little, prairie dogs, whatever. And I thought of a snake. So I designed a snake, and the prop idea, I put a football helmet on him, and he had a cute look. And so Joe liked it, and he went back to the network, and then they bought it because they liked the snake. They didn't like the rabbit. But it's an obscure show. It only was on for, it might have been part of a half-hour show where it was one of the elements. You'd have maybe two or three shorts making up a half-hour show. I can't remember. I don't think it had its own it wasn't a half hour show.
And what was it called? What was it called again?
Blast Off Buzzard.
Blast Off Buzzard. Oh my gosh.
I don't know. I've never tried to see if there's anything on YouTube with that, but you never know. Maybe there's something.
Yeah. I'll have to definitely check that out.
But somebody gave it a name. It was a football player. I think there was a guy named Elroy Hirsch. But there was one, I'm not sure if they called the snake Elroy or some other name, and I can't think of the other name right now. Anyway.
Cool.
I better end on that note then.
All right. And
so, there'll be more things I'm going to recall, but hopefully if we talk again, I'll remember them.
All right, Jerry. Thank you so much.
All right. Thank you for your interest, and thank you for the interview.
Yes, that was great. And I'll talk to you again real soon.
Okay, Todd.
All right, thanks. All right.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Well, I hope you enjoyed the interview as much as I did. I felt like I was talking to an old buddy at the kitchen table, There's just nothing pretentious about Jerry Eisenberg. I mean, he's the real deal and a fantastic interview and a great person. There may even be a sequel to this interview. Who knows in the future? I mean, he's got a lot of stories to tell. We just probably barely tapped the surface here. So I hear the closing music starting to slowly fade in, and that can only mean one thing. My work is done here. Yes, it is finished. Stick around after the music and enjoy the extras I included for your listening pleasure, as I usually do after the closing music finishes. Have a good one, guys. Really, take care, and thank you so much for listening.
Family. And so when the moon shined on little Sherman Fangsworth, he changed into Fangface. The werewolf. Only the sun can change him back to normal. And so little Fangs grew up and teamed up with three daring teenagers, Kim, Biff, and Pugsy. And together they find danger, excitement, and adventure.
Daredevil group of daffy drivers to ever whirl their wheels in the wacky races. Competing for the title of the world's wackiest racer. Cars are approaching the starting line. First is the Turbo Terrific, driven by Peter Perfect. Next, Rufus Roughcut and Sawtooth in the Buzz Wagon. Maneuvering for position is the Army Surplus Special. Right behind is the Ant Hill Mob in their bulletproof bomb. And there's ingenious inventor, Pat Pending, in his converter car. Oh, and here's the lovely Penelope Pitstop, the glamour gal of the gas pedal. Next, we have the Bouldermobile with the Swag Brothers, Rock and Gravel. Lurching along is the Creepy Coupe with the Gruesome Twosome. And right on their tail is the Red Mac. And there's the Arkansas Chugabug with Luke and Blubber Bear. Sneaking along last is that mean machine with those double-dealing do-batters, Dick Dastardly and his sidekick, Muttley. And even now, they're up to some dirty trick, and they're off to a standing start. And why not? They've been chained to a post by Shifty Dick Dastardly, who shifts into the wrong gear. And away they go on the way out wacky races.